I want to welcome all of you in the audience here in New York City to the third Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I agree with what Bob Rosenkrantz just said. We need more civilized discussions of important, even critical topics like the one we're going to be hearing about tonight. I'm going to give you just a brief rundown of this evening. First, we are going to have the proposer of the motion begin by presenting his side of the argument. The opposition will follow. Each person will get a maximum of 8 minutes, and we will go back and forth from one side to the other. Second, when all six speakers have finished with their opening remarks, I'm going to be opening up the floor for brief questions from you in the audience. Third, when the question period from the audience is complete, each of the debaters will make a final statement that will last not more than 2 minutes each. And fourth, during those closing statements, ballot boxes are going to be passed around the auditorium for voting. These are the tickets that you should have in your hands. You will put in either the for piece, it's green, or the against piece, it's red. You'll tear it off, rip it off, and put it in, whichever side you are for, or the whole ticket, if you still don't know which side you favor. If anyone does not have a ticket ballot, an usher will get you one at the appropriate moment. Fifth and last, after the final closing statements have been made, I will announce the results of the audience vote, and we will know then which side has carried the day. We are fortunate tonight to have a very distinguished panel to be our debaters, and I'm going to introduce them now. For the motion, former foreign policy advisor to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and until earlier this month, Israel's ambassador to the United States, Daniel Ayalon. An expert on Arab politics and U.S. Middle East policy from the Council on Foreign Relations, Stephen A. Cook. Author, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and editor-at-large of National Review, John O'Sullivan. And now, against the motion, lawyer and advocate for Muslim and Palestinian activist Stanley L. Cohen. Associate Director of the Harvard Program on Humanitarian Policy and Conflict Research, Mahmoud Ul Mohammadou. And journalist, author, and co-director of the UK DC-based Conflicts Forum, Mark Perry. And now we will begin the debate, and to present the question once again, a democratically elected Hamas is still a terrorist organization. We are going to call on each person to step up to the podium. I'm going to call on them, and we are going to begin with Stephen A. Cook. Four.
Thank you very much for being here this evening. I'd like to thank, first of all, IQ2 and the Rosenkrantz Foundation. And looking out at the audience today, it's truly extraordinary what a diverse group we have. People in the audience who wouldn't normally sit together to discuss such difficult and often emotional issues. I'd also like to thank Judy Woodruff for being here to moderate this debate. And I'd also like to thank my fellow debaters. I am very much looking forward to this evening's intellectual combat. The subject of this evening's debate is, in one sense, rather puzzling. Despite electoral success, Hamas is still a terrorist organization. What is there really to debate here? What does participation in an election have to do with Hamas's profile as a terrorist organization? I'm quite sure that my colleagues on the other side of the debate will tell you that The Palestinian elections were the truest, freest, and fairest in the Arab world. That's an absolutely true statement. They're also going to tell you that the outcome reflected the will of the Palestinian people. That's an absolutely false statement. And three, they're going to tell you that Hamas provides critical social services to Palestinians in need. That is, my friends, totally irrelevant to tonight's subject. These arguments amount to little more than an analytical sleight of hand. An organization can participate in a free and fair election, it can provide social services, and be a terrorist organization. There is no serious scholarly work out there that indicates that any of these activities are mutually exclusive. Despite what Bob Rosenkranz said in his eloquent remarks to open this evening's events, it is not an intellectual position to suggest that Hamas is no longer a terrorist organization. It's an ideological position. It's ideological rather than an analytical conclusion based on the available evidence. Let's consider a few things. I'll leave it to my colleagues to describe for you the numbers of innocents who have been killed at the hands of Hamas. But it's important to provide some historical context here to the evolution of Hamas. Hamas's very founding in the late 1980s was based on an imperative of violence. In the late 1980s, members of the Palestine branch of the Muslim Brotherhood grew concerned that another organization called Islamic Jihad was taking prestige and influence away from them because Islamic Jihad was engaged in violence. Their solution to this political problem was the establishment of Hamas. They would continue the Islamization of Palestinian society from below through the provision of social services in keeping with the historic mission of the Muslim Brotherhood. But they also established a military wing that was dedicated to terrorist acts against Israelis in an effort to burnish their nationalist image and outmaneuver Islamic Jihad. The founding covenant of Hamas, which has not changed, is explicit in its mission to liberate all of historic Palestine through a variety of tactics, including violence. The result has been the bloody carnage on the streets of Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Ashkelon, and numerous other Israeli cities. My critics will say this is old news. Hamas has evolved. It's become a political organization. This, as Mahmoud Mohamadou said, is a historic opportunity. But my question is, has Hamas really evolved? It still denies Israel's right to exist. None of its leaders have renounced the right to armed struggle. The only thing has changed is a tactical change. It has sought to harness the elections that the United States has pushed on the Palestinians to advance its agenda. And what is that agenda? The establishment of a Palestinian state in all of historic Palestine with Sharia, Islamic law, at its core. Well, what about a ceasefire? My critics will tell you there's been a ceasefire since 2003. Be careful about the words that people use when talking about a ceasefire. Hamas calls it a hudna. My colleague Mahmoud Mohamadou calls it tahdiyah. Well, in fact, both of those have a temporary quality to them. Anyone who speaks Arabic should know that a hudna has a finite period of time. It's not much of a ceasefire anyway. Since the Israelis withdrew from the Gaza Strip, they've been victim of rocket assaults on their towns, the kidnapping of their soldiers, and threats to their major cities. Under the weight of available evidence, and I have a little bit of this just before, Stanley and I were standing around before talking about what we did agree on, the Giants, the Yankees, the Knicks, and the desultory state of our teams. And then we got into talking about Hamas, and I said, sure, they wouldn't be a terrorist organization. They just have to lay down their arms. And he said, you're right. The Israelis have to lay down their arms. That's not the point. It's cute. It's funny. But it's not the point. Under the weight of available evidence, supporters of Hamas tend to shift their argument to focus on Israeli behavior. And I should point out, case in point was Judy Woodruff's extraordinary interview with former President Carter last night on the NewsHour. It is true. Israel has expropriated land and continues to illegally settle the West Bank. Israel has killed Palestinian civilians, though unlike Hamas, not intentionally. It has worked assiduously to undermine Mahmoud Abbas and before him Yasser Arafat. All this is very, very true. But it neither alters the fact that Hamas is a terrorist organization nor absolves Hamas of the bloody responsibility for its own behavior. If the issue was Israel's contributed to an environment where extremist ideologies, alienation, and terrorism can thrive, there would be little to debate. But this is not the subject we're examining here this evening. Participation in elections, Hamas's participation in the Palestinian elections, is analytically irrelevant of whether it is a terrorist organization or not. It is a group that remains dedicated to Israel's destruction, and in the process of that destruction, the inevitable killing of innocents. For Hamas to no longer be considered a terrorist organization, it must change its charter, it must renounce its violence, and it must lay down its arms. At that point, and only at that point, can it be seen as a legitimate participant in the political arena. With that, I urge you to vote with the proposition that a democratically elected Hamas is and remains a terrorist organization. Thank you very much.
Against the proposition, Stanley L. Cohen.
I would like to thank everyone for the invitation for tonight. I won't repeat, this is a wonderful event. It's much needed in this city. I find myself sort of changing what I wanted to say as I was sitting here and listening to my adversary. I come from a different perspective. Interestingly enough, I've just returned from Damascus, where I happened to be meeting with the leadership of Hamas. And I bring that to your attention because when I said I was coming to a debate in New York City over whether you're a terrorist organization or not, the leadership said, "You Westerners, you spend all your time debating how many angels are in the head of a pin, and history marches on." And that's not to denigrate or to diminish the significance of this debate, this discussion tonight, but to keep in its perspective that while we debate, while we argue, while we disagree, there is death and destruction on the ground. And while my adversary trivializes the injury to Palestinians, I'd like to sort of begin by really honing in on what we're talking about tonight. Since the year 2000, 4,800 Palestinians, mostly civilians, killed, 839 children under 10, 755 women, 31,750 injured, 800 permanently disabled, 241 extrajudicial assassinations, 11,000 Palestinians, including 380 under the age of 16, and 240 women sitting in jails, most of whom who have never had a trial, have never seen a judge, and do not have counsel. 4,800 homes demolished, 4,200 businesses destroyed, thousands of hectares of olive groves razed. In the last 5 months, while unfortunately Israel has lost 10 civilians, 557 Palestinians, of whom 420 were civilians, including 116 women and 33 children, were killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. Now, collective punishment, that's not the exception. Attacks on the infrastructure, the disruption of water plants, the destruction of electricity, unemployment, infant mortality rates, disease, malnutrition. These are not issues for abstract debate. These are harsh realities for Palestinians. Who did this? Hamas didn't do this. Israel did this. And it's not new. Think back to the British. The Stern Gang, Menachem Begin, a prime minister of Israel, a terrorist. The King David and Semiramis hotels blown up. The UN mediator assassinated by the Stern Gang. Ethnic cleansing with 800,000 Palestinians driven from their homes. 400 villages erased from the map. So this is not some sort of esoteric debate with the West. This is reality, this is truth, and this is 60 years. An unbroken trail of terrorism, not at the hands of Hamas, but at the hands of Israel. Dar Yassin, Sabra Shatila, Jenin, Quinin, Beth Hanun. I love the notion about how Israel, always unlike Hamas, accidentally kills Beth Hanoun last week, 19 women and children sitting in a house, an errant tank shell. Of course, the apologies. Of course, Israel says, oops, we're sorry. We'll have an investigation. And on it goes. And what of international law, the Geneva Conventions that prohibit systematic torture? The Israeli Supreme Court eventually put an end to it. The occupied lands in violation of Israeli law and Geneva Conventions. It goes on and on. 321 condemnations by the United Nations General Assembly ignored. 91 condemnations by the Security Council ignored. There is a double standard. And that's what's interesting, and I mean no disrespect to the debate tonight. As a trial attorney, sometimes I say to a witness, so when did you stop beating your wife? And the witness looks at you like, what are you talking about? And that's the problem with the debate. It starts out with a preconceived notion that Hamas is a terrorist organization. To much of the world, Hamas is not viewed as a terrorist organization, but rather a national liberation movement involved in low-intensity asymmetric warfare. To much of the world, or many in the world community, Israel is viewed as a terrorist state. The problem is civilians are always caught in between. I don't apologize for any civilian getting killed anywhere, but I don't make light of it as if they're just fodder for the Israeli machine. We know in this country we're used to civilian casualties, Sherman's March on Atlanta, the firebombings in Dresden. It goes on. If you're a North American Indian, you're a little bit familiar with terrorism in this particular context. And Israel in the war this summer, a million cluster bombs and anti-personnel mines. There is a fine line between terrorist and freedom fighter, unfortunately, and it is who wins. Every person in the world dies to have a picture taken with Nelson Mandela, who stayed in jail an extra 8 years because he refused to renounce armed struggle. Malcolm X, an American by any means necessary, now he's on postage stamps. So we have to be careful about evolving notions of terrorism. We have to be careful about language and what we suggest to the community. Who is Hamas? Hamas is not just a military wing. It's not just kids strapping explosives on themselves. They're doctors and lawyers and professors and scientists and academics who've given their life to try to get, to try to reclaim what has been stolen from them. Now, you can trivialize the election, but most important, remember, Hamas is millions of people who voted, and many of them, with a bigger plurality than George Bush ever appreciated in his two terms, voted for Hamas. Now, there's a double standard. The West, including Israel, loves Abu Mazen, President Abu Mazen. And why do they love him? Well, because he speaks Western, he talks Western, he walks the walk. He looks good. He's a good Palestinian leader. What's interesting is he's not considered a terrorist, even though he's the titular figurehead of Fatah, which has an armed movement called Al-Aqsa. They do bombings, but he's okay. Hamas is not. Now, what do we know that's happened since the election? Collective punishment. Leaders kidnapped. Cabinet members kidnapped. An attempt to destabilize and topple a legitimate elected government. Economic embargoes and strangulations. Providing arms to the other side. The bottom line here is Hamas is the only group that can deliver. Let us find a way to break out of this cycle, to break out of this abyss, to forget about labels. Labels mean nothing. The only group that can deliver is Hamas. And you know what? If they can't, they'll be voted out. And at the end of the day, it's time to end the embargo. It's time to empty the jails. It's time to stop the attempt to topple a government. But most of all, forget the labels and forget the rhetoric. For 60 years, it has not worked. Give the alternative a chance. Thank you.
Thank you. And now for the proposition, John O'Sullivan.
Madam Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for that kind introduction before, Ms. Woodruff, and I want to share in the general agreement of the panel here that we're grateful for the organizers of this event, of which there ought to be many more in order to stimulate genuinely interesting debate. I will begin by going straight to the topic, because anyone who deals with terrorism has to begin, and I was invited to do this by the last speaker, with its definition. I think he must also scotch the old canard that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. My own definition has the distinction of having been adopted by the Court of Appeals in Canada. If I may quote Mr. Justice Nadon quoting me in the case of Canada versus Majoub in October 2001, the court spoke as follows. A terrorist is a man who murders indiscriminately, distinguishing neither between civilian, innocent and guilty, nor soldier and civilian. He may employ terrorism, planting bombs in restaurants, hijacking planes, in a bad cause or a good one. He may be a Nazi terrorist or an anti-Nazi terrorist, a communist or an anti-communist, pro-Palestinian or pro-Israel. We may want to defeat his political cause or to see it triumph. For his methods, however, the terrorist is always to be condemned. Indeed, to describe him objectively is to condemn him, even if his cause is genuinely a fight for freedom with which we sympathize. Unquote, unquote. Now, we are asked today to consider whether organizations that use terrorist methods as described above should also be admitted into the arena of conventional politics, and in particular to the arena of conventional democratic politics. The motion cites Hamas. But Hamas is not the only organization that combines seeking power through elections with terrorism. Hezbollah does the same. So does the ETA-linked Batzuona party in the Basque region of Spain. So does the two-headed Sinn Féin IRA in Northern Ireland. Nor are these organizations shy about their deeds. They openly boast of employing terrorism, even if they sometimes quibble at the word. Sinn Féin, for example, has said clearly that it sought power through the Armalite rifle and the ballot box. These four parties I've mentioned have enjoyed varying degrees of success. But they all raise the same question. If a democratically elected group employs terrorist methods, should it be regarded as having read itself out of democratic politics, and should we refuse to deal with it? Ideally, I maintain that they should be read out of politics and that we should refuse to deal with them. Indeed, I would go further. When we deal with such bodies as if they are conventional parties, we are making murder respectable. We are, in fact, inciting people to murder. First, because we are saying that murder is no bar to participation in high politics. And when we treat with terrorist parties supported by small numbers of voters, as is true of the Basque Party and it used to be true of Sinn Féin, we are inciting murder a second time because we have admitted we are negotiating with them because they murder people and not for any other reason. When you incite murder, you get more murders. Inciting terrorism has similarly produced a spreading stain of terrorism since the hijackings of Dawson Field in 1970. Let me make a first qualification to this bold statement of principle. If the price of halting a murderous insurgency is to admit the former terrorists into democratic politics, that may sometimes be a price worth paying to save lives and establish a decent political order. But it is a price. The terrorists, moreover, must be former. They must have abandoned terrorism finally, completely and publicly. They cannot be mysteriously linked to terrorists still, or leaving terrorism in a gradual way. They must be exclusively committed to democratic politics and willing to accept its verdicts, even when those verdicts are unfavorable to them. I don't like making that concession. It means that crimes go unpunished, injustice is entrenched, and the moral basency of democracy is tainted. Note, though, that it is a very limited concession. While we may have to deal with former terrorists in official transactions of normal business, we should show them no signs of approval or respect. Even if they hold high government positions, they must be given no state visits, no honorary knighthoods, no White House dinners. Until they have purged their guilt in some way, they must always feel the mark of Cain is on their brow. But the distinguished advocates tonight opposite are proposing something far more dramatic than easing former thugs out of terrorism and into official limousines. They suggest that we should treat as good faith Democrats those who are still engaged in organizing suicide bombings and still planning rocket attacks. Their election, it seems, somehow validates their terror methods, or at least their terror methods do not invalidate their election. Now, here's my second qualification. We are going to reach somewhat different conclusions depending on whether we are citizens of a country in which there is a terrorist group engaged in democratic politics. For example, if we're a Lebanese Democrat in a state which has Hezbollah as a political party. Or depending on whether we are citizens of a state that is the neighbor of a country which has a terrorist government. For example, a citizen of Israel next door to a government that includes Hamas. Take the first case, the citizen of the state in which there is a terrorist party engaged in normal politics. That means that one party in politics has got its own private army and the others do not. It can intimidate the other parties. It can overturn election results. It can ignore political defeats. It is not, in a sense, a normal political party at all, and its very existence is a contradiction of the concept of democracy that most of us would recognize. What happens in such cases? Well, let us take the most favorable case for the other side, that of the Northern Ireland peace process, which most people think has been a good thing. For the first 8 years of this process... Oh, I'm afraid I'm going to skip to the other point. Different principles apply when we're talking about relations between states. If a state is at war with another, whether or not the enemy government is democratic is a very secondary consideration. What matters is the disposition of the state's foreign policy. Does the other state have a serious interest in making peace? If it makes peace, will it keep its word? Does it have long-term aims compatible with a stable peace? Are its internal dynamics such that the government offering to negotiate peace is likely to survive? On strictly practical grounds, it is hard to imagine a prudent citizen answering those questions positively if the other government is composed of terrorists or rooted in a terrorist party. Do terrorists have a serious interest in making peace? Will they keep their word? Are they trustworthy? Do they generally have political aims compatible with the stable peace? We should probably answer all those questions no. And if the terrorist government is democratically elected, the prognosis might be worse rather than better. After all, if an electorate has voluntarily elected a terrorist party, its internal dynamics are unlikely to be favorable to peacemaking and political stability. So for that reason, it doesn't really matter whether or not Hamas is democratically elected. What matters is whether or not it carries on its terrorist methods.
And now, against the proposition, Mahmoud Ul Mohammadou.
Thank you very much, Ms. Woodruff. Let me add my voice to that of my colleagues to thank you and the organizers as well as the audience for this. It's a wonderful opportunity to have indeed intelligent debate. Let me also preface my remarks by saying that my comments tonight are mine alone and don't necessarily reflect the views of my program. Let me pick up the argument where my friend Stan left it, and it is that the inability to transcend the dominant misrepresentation of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands is increasingly becoming problematic for both intelligent debate and informed policymaking. It is a narrative that most people know to be problematic, if not faulty, yet it persists. Tonight's motion fits that pattern, and I invite you to reject it on grounds of inaccuracy and lack of intelligence, for that matter. Hamas is not a terrorist organization. Hamas was the radicalized military expression of a national liberation movement, which grew into a social movement. Hamas is no longer a terrorist organization. Hamas has moved to a political contest which it has joined legitimately and has won fairly. More importantly, Hamas holds high levels of legitimacy among the majority of the people that it has been elected to represent and lead. Now, before developing these arguments, it is important to establish a set of facts, yet there is a a familiar discourse, an emotional discourse about the plight of the Palestinians, which I will not rehearse here tonight. It is a classical discourse which unfortunately has been, in recent years, rendered part of the background noise of world politics, triggering almost a sort of Palestine fatigue. However, and in addition to the facts that Stanley has listed, it is the following facts that are crucial to the assessment of the situation and the proposed motion before us tonight. 39 years of occupation, 1.4 million people in Gaza alone in 360 square kilometers, 540 checkpoints in the West Bank alone, with a 40% increase in that number in the past year, settlements and buildings and land confiscation, the building of a separation wall, not a fence, a wall deemed illegal by the International Court of Justice, daily, near-daily military incursions with sporadic killing, essentially almost half a century of Palestinian disposition, loss of life and freedom. Now, in that most urgent of context, a group that emerges as a resistance movement grows into a social network operating welfare centers and educational services and agrees to abide by the rules of democratic contest can certainly no longer be called terrorist. Now, Canadian definitions notwithstanding, it is important, and this is no mere matter of semantics, to remember that the word terrorist is actually quite problematic when it comes to occupied people. Yes, indeed, the saying, "Your terrorist is my freedom fighter," captures that inherent subjectivity quite well. And some names were mentioned. To those, we can add just this past century, Michael Collins and the IRA, and I will not even mention the Haganah and the Irgun and Itzhak Shamir and others, Nelson Mandela and the ANC, and so on. All of these people have been called by their opponents terrorists, the French resistance fighting the Germans, the FLN fighting the French. Yet time and again, both these individuals and their movements led their groups to national leadership and oftentimes through elections. But the operative world of the motion is still. So is Hamas still a terrorist organization? Well, let us look at what Hamas has done in the past 10 months since their election. Even before that election, Hamas had decided on and implemented a unilateral ceasefire, which it observed for 15 months straight until the Israeli killing this past June of the seven-member Ghalia family. Hamas had made formal statements at the highest level of its multifaceted representation regarding a disposition to enter this long-term truce. Much is made of this concept of hudna. It is important to understand that, in fact, the phraseology used and the legal term is actually quite important in relation to an Islamist movement, which it perforce obligates them to, and indeed is a form of proto-recognition to begin with. Hamas has been part of discussions throughout the summer and the fall on a draft document for a program that would, quote, respect previous agreements in a manner that protects and safeguards the higher interests and the rights of the Palestinian people. Hamas had also proposed a coalition government back in March, which included Palestinian Christians and women, and has folded its executive force into the formal national police. What have Israel, the EU, and the United States done in the same time frame? Insisting on this threefold demand that Hamas recognizes Israel, forswears violence, and accepts previous Israeli-Palestinian agreements, they have decreed and implemented a crippling international embargo with a new humanitarian crisis by UN reckoning, a security crisis by security specialist reckoning, and indeed some sort of Iraqization of Palestine with the birth in mid-October of Al-Qaeda in Palestine, which sent its first tape, a novelty by Palestinian standards. But at this point, one is really prompted to think, what kind of international community is this that is so blind to the injustice that it rationalizes and the one that it perpetuates out of ill-conceived and impatient policies? But the argument I'm putting before you is not an emotional one. It is not an ideological one. It is actually a rational one. The obvious problem with the threefold demand is the disappearance of reciprocity. For the very same three demands could be put, but are not, to Israel. Israel has yet to recognize the existence of a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders. Israel has yet to stop its use of violence against occupied people, including women and children. And Israel has yet to implement the very agreements that it's made with Palestinian representatives. It is therefore contradictory to depict Hamas as still a terrorist organization while punishing Palestinians for their democratic choice. It should also be said that we're, in effect, asking Hamas to be held to agreements which we no longer trust. While everyone is saying that Oslo is dead and that we need new thinking and moving on, we are asking this newcomer to be held to these agreements which have faded or are certainly fading, and in effect holding them to our own liabilities and failures. Contradiction is also displayed through a reading of the facts. There is no internationally agreed definition of terrorism, which is already an evidence of that problem. However, by law, what qualifies a group as a group, an entity as terrorist, is the indiscriminate targeting of civilians. So for the law to have any consistent currency, it has to be applied across the board and certainly not selectively. Which leads me to my last element. Hamas is an adolescent Hezbollah, and look at what Hezbollah has become next door, the strongest power in Lebanon and the first one to ever defeat Israel. So there's a sort of the assumption that Hamas can be extricated from that political reality is unrealistic. Ladies and gentlemen, given half a chance, Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh and his Hamas colleagues are Jerry Adamses in the making. Voting for this motion essentially means endorsing and supporting a unilateral, sterile understanding of this conflict. I invite you to exercise intelligence, display fairness, and vote against the motion. Thank you for your attention.
And against the proposition, I'm sorry, for the proposition, I misspoke, for the proposition, Daniel Ayalon.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Now start the clock now. Good evening. Thank you very much for being here. With all due respect to my colleagues on my team, Stephen Cook and John O'Sullivan, who did a fantastic job, I must even thank more our adversaries, Stanley Cohen and Mahmoud, which did a great job actually convincing you, I'm sure, to actually vote for the motion that Hamas is a terror organization. Actually, I will depart. Naively, I thought that they will relate to the nature of Hamas. What do they do? What do they believe in? What is their conduct? But no, they actually opened the debate to a more geopolitical and historic issues, which actually leave me on a much firmer ground. So I will depart from the notes I prepared here, and I will answer my esteemed colleagues here on the other side who talked about occupation, who talked about Israeli aggression, who talked about UN resolutions, and I will say something which is very, very simple. Israel was attacked in 1967 practically by three countries around us, Jordan, Egypt, and Syria. The occupation, quote-unquote, as they call it, is this territory which was obtained by Israel as an act of self-defense. These three countries and others were trying to push us into the sea and actually destroy Israel, destroy the Jewish people who came back to their historic land, to their biblical land, to the place where they belong. Now, the war happened in 1967. Israel was created in was recreated in 1948. From 1948 to 1967, 19 years, there was no occupation. West Bank belonged to Jordan. Gaza belonged to Egypt. Nobody talked about occupation then. Nobody talked about creating a Palestinian state. You know why? Because they wanted to create this Palestinian state right where Israel is now today, killing all the Jews. So, from 1967 on, against our will, we had to defend ourselves and obtain possession of these territories. But still, we always wanted peace. The proof, 1977, when we had a leader like Anwar Sadat of Egypt, and he signed a peace treaty with us, and he renounced terror and violence, and he recognized Israel. Israel withdrew entirely from the Sinai, having peace with Jordan now for more than 30 years, with Egypt for more than 30 years. 1995, Jordan, King Hussein, a great leader, wanted to make peace. We made peace. We withdrew from all the land that we occupied from Jordan, and there is a peace between Israel and Jordan. recognizing each other, respecting each other, and not shooting at each other. In 1993, Israel, believing that the Palestinians really had a change of heart and they would like to make peace with us, we signed the Oslo Accord. And the Oslo Accord was a very simple deal. Land for peace. Israel withdrawing from West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinians get a hold of themselves, stop the terror, and becoming a responsible party. 2000, Camp David. Former Prime Minister Barak meeting with Arafat to try and make peace. Barak is offering to withdraw from the entire territories, but this was not accepted by Arafat. Not only it was not accepted, but after it was rejected, this intifada started. Intifada is a misnomer. It was a very planned, pre-planned campaign of terror, which cost more than 1,000 Israeli lives, many children, devastation in our cities, and continued rejection of the very notion of the right of Israel to exist in its homeland. Now, people compare between Camp David 78 that succeeded with Saddam Hussein, with Sadat. I'm very tired. I came back from Israel not a few hours ago. Between Sadat and Arafat, Camp David 2000, what was the difference? The difference was leadership. Sadat wanted to make peace. He prevailed over the advice of his advisors and signed the peace treaty. Arafat also, unfortunately, prevailed over the advice of his advisors, who said, sign the peace treaty because you will not get a better deal, and he was against it. Now, Hamas was against Arafat. They did not even believe in the negotiations. They are against, and they were against this Oslo. Why? Because they do not believe in Israel's right to exist. They do not believe in coexistence. They do not believe in peace. They do not believe even in a democracy, because they would like to have a one Islamist Palestinian country, a la Iran, Iran style, and under the Sharia, the law of Islam. So let's go back to the debate tonight. What is the definition of terror? Killing intentionally of innocent people. What does Hamas do? Killing only children and innocent people. They send terrorists strapped in explosives into markets, into pizzerias, into coffee shops, and into school buses and kindergartens. This is what they do. Are they a terrorist organization? If this is the definition of terror, they definitely are a terror organization. Secondly, do they believe in coexistence? No, they deny Israel's right to exist. Now, people here are talking about we're elected democratically or not. This is beside the point. Just look into the Hamas, www.hamas.com, in their website, in the internet, and look into the Hamas charter. They believe in killing. They don't believe in Israel. They don't believe in any peace. So are they a terror organization? According to this definition, they are as well. Now, there is also another issue here. Who is Hamas operated by? Are they really doing the will of the people? I don't think so. My esteemed colleague here on the other side, Stanley Cohen, said he just returned from Damascus, and he met Khaled Mashal. Where did he meet Khaled Mashal? In Damascus. Who is really operating Khaled Mashal? The Syrians and the Iranians. So they're not really playing. They're not really representing Palestinian authentic interests. They are representing the interests of these crazy Islamists in Tehran and in Damascus. Are they a terror organization? I think yes. I think all of you should vote for this motion. Now, there is this question whether they were democratically elected. Well, I would say a broad definition of democracy is, you know, doing the will of the people, but also observing the rule of law. And the rule of law does not permit gangs to be brandishing their guns and going with bullets into the ballots. Don't take just the case of Hamas. Look at what happens. I mean, we should apply in this global world, global community, the same yardstick for everywhere. There were elections held in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in the former Yugoslavia. In all these elections, armed gangs were denied the right of voting and also of being elected. The same case should have been with Hamas, but for some reason, this thing was ignored, and Hamas was allowed to run. And I think this was a mistake. Unfortunately, Hamas won, but it's not because the people voted for their ideology. It's because it was a protest vote against Fatah, which was corrupt and ineffective. So this is the reason why Hamas was elected. Did it change their character? Not at all. Does the formal process change intrinsically what Hamas stand for? Now, after the elections, they still are killing. There were more than 1,000 rockets fired from Gaza into our towns, killing babies and children. And there's no reason for that, since we left Gaza entirely. We left Gaza entirely in order to give the Palestinians a chance to show everybody that they can govern themselves responsibly, that they can do away with terror and incitement and start negotiating with us.
Time is up.
Just vote for the motion.
Thank you very much.
And the final opening argument is an argument against from Mark Perry.
The problem isn't that Hamas is a terrorist organization. The problem is that Hamas is a Muslim organization. That's what scares the hell out of us. And we ought to put it all out on the table and just say it. And how do we know that? Because the United States has dealt with terrorist organizations throughout its history, and so has Israel. There were no preconditions for any talks with the PLO in 1993. And Yasser Arafat made sure of that. He said, we'll recognize you after you talk to us. That was no preconditions. Why do we have conditions on Hamas? Because they're Muslims, they don't wear suits, they don't look like us. We say they don't have our values. How do I know that we deal with terrorist organizations? Because tomorrow, the President of the United States is meeting with a man by the name of Nouri al-Maliki. Who is he? Nouri al-Maliki is the head of the Dawah Party. Who's the Dawah Party? The Dawah Party opposed Saddam Hussein. When we supported Saddam Hussein, we put him on the terrorism list. When we changed sides, we took him off the terrorism list. That doesn't matter. They bombed the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait and killed 3 Americans. We're talking to them because it's in our interest to talk to them, terrorist or not. So what is the problem with Hamas? Well, if you listen to the media and if you listen to our political leaders, here's what they have to say. They don't have our values, our Judeo-Christian values. What values would those be? I'm a nice white boy from Wisconsin, grew up as a Lutheran, and I can tell you, in my religion, and I had to memorize through an ordeal, the catechism of Martin Luther, one of the real anti-Semites of our era. They do not have legitimacy. How do political parties and movements gain legitimacy? It's not conferred by Israel or the United States, it's conferred by the people. They won an election. Oh no, their critics say. They didn't win the election. Fatah lost it. Okay, Fatah lost it because Fatah couldn't organize itself credibly and competently to stand for election, and because Fatah accepted $20 million in American election aid, and as soon as that came out in the Washington Post and was reprinted in the West Bank and Gaza, they lost votes. They want to destroy Israel. So did the PLO. They have a charter that says they want to destroy Israel. So did the PLO. And yet we've had Hamas leaders that say the following. We have a charter that says, yes, we admit it, we want to destroy Israel. But the charter is not the Quran, and it can be changed. And under the right circumstances, if we can talk to our adversaries, we can and we will change it. The other argument that we say, we've heard it tonight, they provide social services. Those cynical people, how could they do that? You mean they're actually trying to serve their people, clear up corruption? I, too, was talking to Hamas leaders when I was in the Middle East just 1 week ago. Osama Hamdan, the foreign minister of Hamas. Here's what they've done. They've penetrated the education and health ministries, cleaned them up. That's 40% of the total employment in the government of Palestine. They've thrown out the corrupt people. They've taken over the ministry. They've started to provide service to their people. They've kicked out Fatah members who are in exile around the world for stealing money from the Palestinian people. Don't we want good governance? Shouldn't we talk to people who want good governance, who stand for elections? They kill innocent people. They have killed innocent people. Brutally, terribly, like others have. It's not an excuse to say, well, the Israelis have done it. Well, Lehi did it. Well, the Haganah did it. That's not an excuse. They killed innocent people, and they cannot be absolved. But after long discussions with Hamas conducted by my organization, painful discussions, arguments about the killing of innocents, not moral arguments, practical, effective, political arguments, they stopped. I'd like to take credit. They stopped these suicide bombings through talk because they realized how ineffective they were, how they were losing support for what they feel is a legitimate cause. There hasn't been a Hamas-led suicide bombing in Israel since August of 2004. That's a fact. People can change. There are three conditions for Hamas being recognized as a legitimate political party: to renounce violence, to give up their arms, and to recognize Israel. We've been through this and through this with Hamas. We said, why don't you do this? And the best answer that I've had from a Hamas leader is as follows. If we do that, if we renounce violence, if we give up our arms, and if we recognize Israel, what's there to talk about? What do we talk to our enemies about? Do you think they're going to say, oh, welcome to the world of nations. Fine, we'll withdraw to the 67 borders. Here's what we would like. We will recognize Israel. Haleb Mishal has said this very straightforward in Damascus again and again and again and again. We understand and we recognize that the Israeli people, the Jewish people, have a narrative. It's an important narrative. We've listened to it for many, many years. We have a narrative. Here's our narrative. In 1948, we lived in a land that was called Palestine. Many of us were kicked off our land and now live in refugee camps. We have legitimate grievances. If you will recognize our legitimate grievances and recognize our narrative as a people, we can begin to share a narrative, to have talks. But until that point comes, when you stand up and say, we understand that you have grievances that have to be addressed, we're not going to recognize anybody. We're going to represent our people. Now, here's what's happening, I think, in the Middle East. Now, and I just returned from Beirut, there are, on the internet, calls for the assassination of the leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas by the leaders of Al-Qaeda. Why? Because Hamas and Hezbollah have accepted the Western colonial mandate to stand for elections and represent their people. Al-Qaeda thinks that's a trick. Hamas and Hezbollah don't. They answer to their people. We are lumping together the Girondins with the Jacobins. We are lumping together the true reformers in the Middle East, the ones who want to answer to their people, with the people who drove their airplanes into our buildings. We are forcing the Gironde, for those of you who remember French history, into the mountain, into the Jacobins. It is so counterproductive. We are radicalizing the region. There are moderates in Islam. They're called Hamas, whether we like it or not. And it's time to open up to them. I thank you.
Thank you very much to our six debaters, 3 for and 3 against. And I'm now ready to announce, to tell you the results of the vote that was taken before tonight's debate began. Before the debate, we've counted the ballots. 161 of you voted for the motion, 51 of you voted against the motion, and 56 of you said you didn't know. And to remind, the motion is a democratically elected Hamas is still a terrorist organization. Again, 161 in favor, 51 against, and 56 of you said you had not made up your mind. Now, we are ready to begin the audience question portion of the program. I'm going to call on the questioners. We have someone on each side of the auditorium here who is going to come to you with a microphone. And we ask that you stand when you ask your question, and we also ask that you please make your question short and to the point. We ask that members of the press identify yourselves, tell us who you are, and we ask that members of the audience who are not in the press, we want to tell you you have the option to either identify yourself or not. So we will get underway, and let's see. We have a question here in the front. Yes.
This is for the people who are for the motion. It seems that the U.S. wants democratically elected governments in the Middle East only if it's one that they like, not just Hamas, but, for example, the reticence to have free and fair elections in Egypt out of concern that the Muslim Brotherhood would prevail. Isn't that a little bit hypocritical? And as a corollary to that, when these groups are actually voted in, doesn't the necessity of governance and the compromises they have to make in order to govern moderate them anyway?
Is that directed at one individual or any one of the those? All right.
I may take a different view from some of my colleagues on this side of the aisle on this question. As a matter of fact, my sticking point is violence. Do groups who are standing for election continue to advocate and practice violence? That, to me, is the sine qua non. If they do, if they maintain a private army, if they are acting as, for example, the IRA continue act for some years after the Good Friday Agreement, I'm against that. Now, I think in the case of Islamists standing for election, I'm absolutely in favor of it. I think the American government is taking a risk in urging free elections when they'll sometimes bring to power people who are hostile to American foreign policy. But that's a risk which we have to take. After all, it's a risk which we take with every other part of the world, and we have to live with that. I think in the case of Hamas, we put ourselves in a somewhat false position. And this is a rather complicated point here, but once we had accepted the legitimacy of Hamas standing, it seems to me we had crossed that Rubicon. And once having been elected, we simply had to accept that they were there. I would not have said that they were a legitimate contender in the election myself until, as I say, they had abandoned violence, which is my, in a sense, not my sole criterion perhaps, but my overriding criterion.
Can I just add something to that, Judy?
Sure.
On this question of the United States only liking the people that gets elected, and you mentioned the issue of Egypt, and since I'm writing a book about Egypt, I feel compelled to respond. There's not a single Egyptian official, nor is there a single American government official who believes that the United States is no longer pressuring the Egyptians on democratic reform. It's just not true. In fact, I was in Cairo in September, and at the same time that the United States government presented papers to the Egyptian government that included benchmarks for democratic change, and that is even with 88 members of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Egyptian parliament. The difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas is that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has not engaged in an act of violence since at least the 1970s. You can't say the same thing about Hamas. Well, that's terrific. They haven't engaged in violence since 2004.
There's been a million people that belong to the Muslim Brotherhood and probably 200,000 in Egypt that are in jail. Because as soon as the Muslim Brotherhood tries to run for election, they get jailed.
They won.
They get tortured. They didn't.
88 members won. Come on.
Who's controlling Egypt right now? The Brotherhood?
We clearly know. We clearly know who's controlling Egypt.
The question asked is, do we support democracies that we like, and do we oppose democracies that we don't? And the reality of it is, when Musharraf...
Actually, you don't know. You have absolutely no understanding of what the U.S. government is doing right now to promote democracy in the Middle East.
Ask the audience. This is all very entertaining. Every night on television, what the United States is doing to promote democracy. If you're with us, you're okay. If you're not, you're a good Muslim or you're a bad Muslim, Mr. Bush. It doesn't change, no matter what you want to call it.
Who's going to be the next president of Egypt? You think he's going to be democratically elected? Right. Or is he going to be the son of
Mubarak? Or Jordan, that other bastion of support, progressive ideology that the Israeli ambassador supports. You're good if you're with us, and if you're not, you're not. And it really doesn't matter. If you follow our politics, you're a good guy, and if you don't, your traith. How's that, expert in Egypt?
Well, I think this is... I think that this is really nonsense. I think we are here talking, you know, in just slogans, democracy. First of all, we have to remember, you know, elections. Democracy doesn't start with elections. It doesn't end with elections.
I've got one for you.
There is a culture. There should be a rule of law. There should be a participation of all walks of life in a society. Unfortunately, we have a backward situation in all the Muslim and Arab countries, where there is no, basically, there is no middle class. There is only elite who really control all the resources, all the political power, all the economics, and everything else. And all the others are poor, uneducated, and really they are subject to the incitement of the ideological zealots from Iran.
What an
and
arrogant statement to talk about a 5,000-year-old culture.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm talking about facts. I'm just talking about facts. So what I would answer to you is, no, we should not promote democracy in the Middle East. What we should promote is equal opportunities. What we should promote is empowerment of women. What we should promote is good education for the people, so there's not these inequalities. And when the people themselves will have a stake in their own lives, in their societies, they will decide what type of regime they want.
What the ambassador means to say is there won't be a vote until the people are ready, which is just exactly what J. Edgar Hoover said about African Americans in America 30 years ago.
This has nothing to do with that, and irrelevant.
Just a quick comment on this, with all due respect to the ambassador.
And then we'll get to the next question.
This is precisely what I meant by unilateral understanding. We hear it here again. We have to decide this. We have to support. It's very, very paternalistic. It's as if all of these populations have no sense of what is important to them, what is legitimate for them, who stands for them. I mean, Fatah has lost all credibility in that area, not simply because of external support, essentially for what they've done with the building of apartments in Dubai and so on and so forth. The people know who stands for them. People know who will defend them. And if Hamas has left that scene, which was, as I said, a military scene, has chosen to represent a democratic in a democratic way these groups, then it's something that speaks for the values of these people. And keep in mind as well who was fielded in these elections. Pharmacists, doctors, professors, I mean, business, women. I mean, this is not simply a group of, as you call them earlier, thugs in limousines. Khaled Mash'al last week in his press conference was citing foreign affairs articles by Richard Haass. I mean, we really have to be a little bit more sophisticated.
All right, we've had a good discussion now on this question, and I think we do need to move to the next.
No,
I think we've given each of
you. I think it's important because they keep raising this issue of being pharmacists and doctors and all that. Let me tell you, there are millions of engineers and doctors and professors and musicians in the 30s who voted for the Nazi Party, and which brought on the Holocaust.
I think that's
so don't come with me with doctors and professors and other men. It's not their title. It's not their title. It's their conduct and what they believe in. This is what should be the yardstick.
All right.
Not their diplomas.
As long as the Iranians
not their diplomas.
What to do? Is that correct?
We are not going to resolve this now. We need to let the next person have a question. Yes, I believe. Yes, sir. You've been patiently waiting.
Hi. My question is for the against side, specifically for the gentlemen who have had direct conversations with Hamas. If Hamas refuses to recognize Israel, how can the organization support a two-state solution?
Well, long before there was Hamas, governments say things all the time. People say things all the time. If Hamas tomorrow said, we recognize the state of Israel, the right of Israel to exist, the ambassador would say, prove it. Come back to us in 20 years when you've shown we'll accept it for 20 years. The reality of it is I'm not concerned about what people say they will do. I'm more concerned about what, in fact, they do and on the ground. The reality of it is that you've got statements that have come as close as are going to come, that talk about if we go back to the 67 borders, that is the starting point, and that's where we're going to move. Every day the United States government makes statements. There's weapons of mass destruction. We go into Iraq. You know what? No weapons of mass destruction. Don't get hung up on the rhetoric of labels. Don't get hung up on we recognize your right to exist. What about recognizing the right of return? Stanley Cohen can go home, but if my name is Mahmoud, I can't go home. So you have to be reciprocal. I haven't heard a word from Israel about the right of return. I haven't heard a word from Israel about the right to a government. I haven't heard a word from Israel about the right to recognize what the Palestinian people want.
You want unilateral concessions.
What?
Can I answer to that? Well, don't judge us
And don't tell me what Israel will say for 20 more years. Just judge us by our deeds. When Egypt was ready to recognize Israel, we signed a peace treaty. The same with Jordan. The same with the PLO. And I take issue. I think it's incorrect what you mentioned here. Israel was ready to recognize the PLO and talk to them only and only after Yitzhak Rabin, late Yitzhak Rabin, received a letter signed by Yasser Arafat, 9th of September, 93, which renounced terror, which recognized Israel's right to exist, and which also promised to change this charter that you're talking about. This is exactly what we are expecting from Hamas. And this is not just an Israeli expectation. This is a demand by the entire international community, as was expressed by the quartet, the four parties that are responsible for the peace process in the Middle East, which called for the Hamas, after they were elected, they said, okay, you were elected, doesn't matter if it was democratically or not, doesn't matter if you're a terror organization, let's look and move forward. And Israel is in that camp. Let's look and move forward. Not about what you did, the fact that you already fired Qassam rockets this morning, killing a baby in Shderot. Let's look to the future. And we still say, if you renounce terror, if you recognize Israel's right to exist and you abolish your charter, and now also if you accept all previous agreements which were signed by the PLO, then you are a legitimate partner. But they are not doing that because they are still a terror organization, so because they do not believe in coexistence, and they do believe not in building a nation but destroying one, which is ours, and we are not going to let them do that. You're talking about Stanley Cohen, about the right of return. What kind of a right of return? There's no right of return. There were Arabs there, which we wanted to coexist with them, but they were killing Jews.
It's all a conspiracy don't tell me the Iran talk. And Syria. 800,000 people just woke up and
Just read history. Just read history, and then you will know there is not such a thing as right of return. There is a problem of the refugees. This is true. There is a refugee problem, but the responsibility for the refugee problems lie on the heads of the leaders of the Palestinians and of the Arabs.
All right. We have a question. I see a hand right there.
My name is Michael Bronner. I'm a freelance writer. There's something that seems very myopic about this conversation with the war raging in Iran and Lebanon. This sort of insoluble binary seems to have spread to the whole world in terms of who's a terrorist, who's a Democrat, who's right, and who's wrong. You hear repeatedly that the key to peace in the region and the world is in the Israel-Palestine conflict. This is for anyone in the panel. Do you still think that that's true?
For anyone on the panel?
Yeah.
All right. We'll begin with this side because we heard last week.
Well, thank you. And let me, if I may, simply remind us of the motion that this debate is not about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The motion is about the last 10 months and whether Hamas is still a terrorist organization. And the facts are that everything that Hamas did over the past 10 months cannot be qualified as terrorist. I mean, you can come up with previous arguments.
Even indiscriminate firing at children,
well,
schools in Shderot.
It's interesting you should say that, because when you look at it, you will find out, and sir, I think you should know that it was actually the violations that came from the Fatah side. And the Fatah that was associated with that, as well
not
as
at all.
Well,
Fatah is trying to
Ghazi
fight
Hamad
Hamas.
Is the name of the person that actually speaks about these matters, and you can go and check and see every single one of the actions that was in violation was denounced by Hamas officially. So again, facts or statements.
Who holds Corporal Shalit, which was kidnapped in our territory?
I wouldn't know.
It's the Hamas. Who is not? Well, you would know.
10,000 Palestinians sitting in jail that haven't seen.
But
they haven't been on
trial. They are all terrorists, and this is the difference.
They're all
terrorists.
All 10,000 Palestinians, including the 14-year-olds,
let me tell you that they are not
put
just
them on trial.
It's not just these 10,000.
You have a democracy.
There are 50,000 more.
You have a democracy. Mm-hmm. Let them go. Let them have trials.
They
prove
all
your case.
They are all being trialed. They're all
let
being
me,
processed.
Let me
and
answer
I wish
the
same
yes.
chance was given to the Israeli
sir.
Kids who are being targeted by these guys.
Oops. I know, there
yes.
we go again. Every time those darn Palestinians get in the way of our missiles and our tanks and end up dead, whoops, there it goes again. But yet when we do it, we're sorry. But you target, and that's the moral superiority. So the moral position that you've always taken. Look, it's terrible when civilians on both sides get killed. It's terrible. It's got to stop. And the way you stop it is you dare to struggle. You break the labels, you sit down with no preconditions, and you try to move ahead. And if it doesn't work, you're right back to where you were, but at least there's a chance.
Okay. Absolutely. This is exactly what we want. We say, stop the killing, stop the terror, and we will sit and talk. What will we talk about? What we will talk about? The roadmap to peace.
We only have about 4 minutes left for questions, so I do want to recognize someone there in the very back, please. Stand up.
I have a question. My name is Golden. I'm a teacher. I have a question to Mr. Cohen. If your argument together with Hamas would be accepted, if everything going on according to your plan and you would win, would you go for even a short visit to Israel just to recognize, just to receive congratulations? Would you take such risk?
I go to Israel all the time. In fact, sir, sir, I lost family in a bombing in Jerusalem. I lost family in World War II. I cannot tell you how difficult it is for me as a Jew to sit back and for 60 years watch what has occurred. And not just in the name of people in Israel, but in the names of Jews all over the world. The answer is, yes, I would go. And yes, I would gladly do what has to be done to break bread and to try to bring some sanity to this war of labeling. That's the problem. We are so locked into labels. We are so locked into an inability. You must do this or I'll do that. I must do this or you'll do that. There's absolutely no downside to sitting down without preconditions and talking.
Absolutely.
John O'Sullivan.
But without killing. But without killing.
John O'Sullivan has been asking for
I think that there are, just on the general point here, there are consequences to launching unsuccessful wars against Israel. The first is that Israel ends up with territories which didn't originally belong to it. The second is that there are going to be large numbers of refugees. And the third is that the Israelis, given their strategic long-term vulnerability, are going to be very suspicious of proposals for peace that don't come accompanied by guarantees but do come accompanied by demands for a right of return that would negate the Jewish state altogether.
Okay. We have time for one more audience question, preferably a short one. And please tell us who it's directed to. Let's see. Where do we have someone with a microphone up there? Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to ask two brief questions, and I'd like to thank Mr.
Let's
O'Sullivan.
Let's make it one.
Okay.
We have 2 minutes.
I'd like to thank Mr. O'Sullivan and Mr. Perry for, I think, making the most intelligent arguments tonight. I just want to ask the fourth side how they, if they feel that political power is a moderating force on extremists, and how their view of terrorism is consistent with the actions of David Ben-Gurion and the bombing of the King David Hotel.
Who would like to pick Stephen?
I'll
Stephen Cook.
I'll go for it. Thank you very much. I think that there's really no connection. The pothole theory of politics, that somehow Hamas, which is dedicated to a broader ideological agenda, is somehow going to have to pick up the garbage that is going to moderate their view of the world. That certainly didn't happen with the PLO once it returned to Gaza. I don't expect it will happen with Hamas. Now, of course, the question of the bombing of the King David Hotel, everybody trucks that out as evidence of terrorism. The fact that the Israelis before in the pre-state era engaged in terrorism. My understanding of the bombing of the King David Hotel was that it was not directed specifically against innocent civilians, but it was against British occupation authorities. That is not consistent with the definition of terrorism.
All right. Thank you.
There were terrorist acts against British troops during the war, by the way, just to make that point.
All right. It is now time for all of you who are in the audience. This is the moment. This is time to vote. This is the ticket. Pull it out of your pocket or your lap, wherever it is, your handbag. If you want to vote for the motion, tear off the four, the green four, from the ticket, the top of the ticket, and slip it into the ballot box that will be passed among you. If you want to vote against, tear off against the red. Tear off the red against and put that into the ballot box. And if you do not know which side you're on, if you are undecided, put your entire ticket into the ballot box. The ballot boxes are going to be passed around by the ushers, the front and the back of the auditorium. Pass it to the next person. We want to make sure everybody's vote is counted. If you need a ticket, just wave your arm in the air. The ushers have extra tickets. Everyone gets one vote. And now we are going to turn, while you're finishing this up, we're going to turn to the panelists, beginning with the side opposing the motion, and we are going to ask them to make their final argument. So, opposing the motion against Stanley Cohen. 2 minutes.
Sure, a lot more difficult debating here than it was in Qatar or in Doha. I have a friend, a dear friend of mine, believe it or not, an Israeli named Leah Tzemel. She's a famous Israeli lawyer. She used to be called Arafat's whore by Israeli politicians. Leah said to me one day when we were driving to the Erez crossing where we had to wait 12 hours to go in to see people, Leah said in response to a comment about how they want to drive us to the sea and drown us, Leah said, the only one who's going to drive us to the sea and drown us is ourselves. The notion that Palestinians have nothing to do but to die or to kill after all of this time is the difficulty. We see resistance as this desire and this need to be terrorist and to die and kill, which is defied by what's happening on the ground. The real shame here, the real sin here, is for the first time in history, Palestinian and Israeli kids aren't going to schools together. They're not spending time together. They're not falling in love together. They're not doing businesses together. And the problem is the walls of labels are keeping sides apart. People say Hamas is a terrorist organization. I say Israel's a terrorist state. Who cares? The two sides need to sit down without preconditions, see if you can find common ground as people to grow so those kids can fall in love again. Thank you very much.
And now for the motion, Stephen A. Cook.
It's amazing, isn't it? Everything I told you would happen, happened. Our interlocutors on the other side did not address the issue at hand. They shifted to Israeli behavior. But I want to respond to some specific things that each of them said to demonstrate how weak their arguments are. And since Stanley impugned my credibility and my expertise, I'll return the favor. Stanley spoke passionately, ponytail waving, arms in the air, doing the whole hippie thing, talking about many or most in the world believe. Come on, Stanley. I got my PhD because I didn't need to go to law school because I'm the son of a lawyer. You should know, every first-year law student knows that when you argue it, many in the world, most people believe, it's a logical fallacy. Just because most people believe it doesn't make it true. What is Mahmoud talking about when he talks about proto-recognition? Is that like being half pregnant? You can't be half pregnant. You either recognize or you don't. Throughout the 1990s, I spent my time parsing the words of Palestinian leaders. Do they or do they not recognize? What is proto-recognition? Hudna means somehow recognition, but Hudna's end. I don't understand it. The majority of the Palestinians did not vote for Hamas. 44% of the people voted for Hamas. Now, I'm sure the people on the other side of the room would say that George Bush was not democratically elected because the majority of Americans didn't vote for him in 2000. Well, I would apply the same principle to Hamas. I'm shocked. I'm actually shocked that Mark Perry's interlocutor is Osama Hamdan. I'll skip that part. I'll just say that it is extraordinary that Mark Perry gave all the evidence you needed to vote for the proposition. He said, his Hamas interlocutor said, that they would not give up violence because it's a bargaining chip. So thus, the lives of innocents is a bargaining chip. It's a political power play on the part of Hamas. They will continue their terrorism. Thank you. I urge you to vote for. Oh, well, you've already voted, so thanks for your vote.
Against the motion, Mohammed Oud Mohammedou.
Thank you very much. Well, I had a bit of an uplifting argument to finish with, but I guess that, unfortunately, we've moved from intelligent debate to cuteness apparently winning it. And it's a pity because the whole debate was not necessarily about this pro-Israeli or pro-Arab or pro-Palestinian. It's really something different. It was about justice. People fighting a justice are not terrorists. It's about international legality. Wars of national liberation are not terrorism. And it's about the cogency of our moral principles. But it seems that all of this cuteness that was adopted to address these life and death matters seems to have won the room. And, you know, fine. But again, back to Stanley's point, history marches on. And although one might think that there's something inevitable about the Arab-Israeli conflict, I, for one, would like to believe that it's not. Imagine if the EU were to call a Hamas delegation and have an adult conversation with them. Imagine if the Secretary of State were to address elected officials and invite them and discuss with them. Imagine if the Israeli population elected a government from which they asked an end to inhumane policies and negotiations with whomever is in charge. This, I think, would quell the violence on both sides, resuscitate the peace talks, and get us into a new dynamic. You don't have to imagine the other opposite situations. We're in it, and we'll continue to be in it as long as motions such as tonight will continue to be vetted. Thank you.
Thank you. For the motion, John O'Sullivan.
Well, I'm delighted that there are distinguished psychiatrists, doctors, lawyers, and so on in Hamas. And at the moment, Radovan Karadzic is on the run from NATO as a war criminal. He himself was a child psychiatrist before the war started. I wondered what became of his charges. It's unusual for me to find myself as the idealist on the platform. But I point out that the argument that we should be having, as well as the particular argument about the Middle East, is an argument about violence in politics. When violence enters politics, it's very hard to drive it out again. And when indiscriminate violence against innocent people enters, it damages a society very strongly indeed. Now, that's not the only way to have a revolution. Polish solidarity won independence from Russia, and that has been repeated in Georgia and in the Ukraine and elsewhere by a campaign of moral resistance and cultural resistance that wore down the opposition and persuaded people to come over to it. That's the kind of revolution, if one is needed, that's the kind of revolution recourse that we should encourage people to pursue. We should not turn a blind eye to their crimes because they have managed to be elected. It's a fine thing to be elected, but it doesn't absolve you from the laws of human conduct that the rest of us are supposed to obey.
In our final argument against, Mark Perry.
We won't be here 2 years from now. 2 years from now, debating this question, because by 2 years from now, this debate will be resolved. Why? Because Israel will be talking to Hamas. That's why. Because they're talking to them right now. How do we know that? Because there's a proposed ceasefire in Gaza in which Haleh Mishal traveled to Cairo, and Ehud Olmert said, "If you can stop those rockets, we'll withdraw from Gaza." Now that might not be eyeball to eyeball talks, but that's a political understanding. And how did that happen? It happened because George Bush is going to Amman, Jordan, and Dick Cheney is going to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to talk to those guys about helping us out in Iraq, and they're looking at him and saying, how are we going to do that when our own people are making a clamor about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And so George Bush and Dick Cheney are picking up the phone and calling Prime Minister Olmert and say, do something. And he's saying, what? I can't. They're a terrorist organization. George Bush is going to go, oh, come on. Where do you think this is? Grow up. Be adults. We've got a world to run. You want to run it? Talk to people. Talk to them. They might be a terrorist organization. Yes, they've killed civilians. Yes, it's a terrible thing. After World War II, we went into Germany. We put 334 people on trial and called it a day. Why? Because we have to go forward. And it's time to go forward. It's time to go forward. Thank you.
And our final debater for the motion, Ambassador Daniel Ayalon.
Yes, thank you. Well, what was the issue today? The issue was of legal, moral, and practical nature. Legal, are they law offenders? They have illegal arms? They breach the law? Yes, Hamas does. Moral issue, are they killers of children and other innocent people? Yes, they are. And of practical issue, just a matter of common sense, is there any sense talking to them? Will talking to them bring peace and quiet? Well, I don't think so. Now, we have to make sure the equation is right. And it's not that they will say, well, we will stop killing you if you give us land, if you give us political concession. This is not the equation. If they stop killing us, we will stop hunting them. When they are ready for political concessions, we will give them political concessions. It's apple to apples, oranges to oranges. This is the issue. And so long as the Palestinians, and Hamas especially, deny recognition of Israel's right to be there in their homeland, there is not going to be peace. And the fact that they continue with this terror, and some would call it resistance, is also a fallacy, because it's not resistance. Israel is ready to build a Palestinian state. Israel was withdrawing from territories, the entire area of Gaza, areas of the West Bank, and we are willing to talk. What are we going to talk about? The roadmap to peace. How to make peace, how to create a Palestinian state which will live side by side with a Jewish Israel. This is at stake now, and so long as the Palestinians do not want to do that, as long as they keep the killing, there is nothing to talk about. They stop the killing, then we talk.
All right, I want to thank all of our debaters. I want to thank all of you in the audience for your excellent questions and your good behavior. It's time now to announce the results of the voting after our debaters did the very best job they could to sway you. Here's the number that we have. 159 voted for the motion. 100 voted against, which is almost a doubling of what it was before. And 52 said, I don't know. So again, 159 for... 100. That means that a number of you didn't vote when you first came in. It looks as if we've got about 50 or so more people who voted at the end. But again, we appreciate the participation of all of our debaters. We thank you in the audience. I want to invite you to return next month for the fourth Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on Wednesday, December 13th, here at the Asia Society and Museum. The motion to be debated is Hollywood has promoted anti-Americanism abroad.